Thank you. Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, members and guests. Today we'll be hearing from the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and a number of interested parties who can talk about a number of related issues that they've been working on in the forestry area. So we'll start with Dr. David Zumeda. Welcome. Do you prefer, is it Zumeda or Zumeda?
Zumeda. Zumeda.
Zumeda.
Yeah, you said it correctly
okay.
The first time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Zumeda. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. We have a presentation for you today regarding the implementation of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act of 1995, which is the act that created the Forest Resources Council. A couple of my staff are with me today, and they'll be introduced in order of the presentation. Some of you who have been around a while recall that the generic environmental impact statement was a million-dollar study back in really 1990 to 1994 that examined the cumulative impacts of three statewide timber harvesting levels on Minnesota's economy and environment. And that study included a number of both tactical and strategic measures to mitigate potential impacts of timber harvesting and forest management. The recommendations from that study ultimately led to passage of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act of 1995. The act led to the creation of the council and had four purposes that were identified for the council: pursue sustainable management, use, and protection of the state's forest resources, encourage cooperation and collaboration across different forest resource interests, recognize and consider the broad array of perspectives on forest resource issues, and recognize and consider the diverse number of forest resource issues that there are out there. Council includes 17 members. A chair and 15 members are appointed by the governor. Minnesota Indian Affairs Council appoints its own member in recognition of the tribes as separate nations under federal law. There are two members from environmental organizations, and there are also two private forest landowners. And then there's one of each of these other categories. But you can see that the council is quite a diverse group of folks. U.S. Forest Service, represented by Jim Sanders, the supervisor of the Superior National Forest. Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners has a representative, Bruce Cox, Clearwater County Land Commissioner, and so on. The council has several responsibilities under the act. I'm just going to cover the main three here. The probably first and foremost is to advise the governor and federal, state, county, and local agencies on forest policies and practices that result in sustainable forest management, use, and protection statewide. Second is a major program area, landscape-level forest planning and coordination. And third is another major program area, comprehensive timber harvesting and forest management guidelines, including several types of monitoring relative to those guidelines that Dr. Phillips will talk about in a little bit. I want to save my voice because I'm not in the best of shape here, and I've asked Dr. Calder Hibbard, who's the council's forest policy analyst, to cover the forest policy program and also the landscape program, and then I'll return later. So, Dr. Hibbard.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Zumeda. Zumeda. Sorry. I don't know. You're just getting these habits, bad habits. Welcome, Dr. Hibbard.
Thank you. My name's Dr. Calder Hibbard. I'm the policy analyst for the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. Chair, committee members, it's a pleasure to be here. As Dr. Zumeda mentioned, there are three major functions or programmatic areas that the Forest Resources Council has, and one of those, and first and foremost, is the Forest Policy Program, which, reminding you, is has to do with advising the governor, other executives, as well as other agencies, both federal, state, county, and other local agencies. About a year ago, the Minnesota Forest Resource Council identified kind of what would be some priority forest policy areas in which they would like to concentrate policy work on over the next, both for 06 as well as 07, past year as well as the coming year. Probably first and foremost was the issue over forest ownership change, parcelization, meaning then the dividing larger parcels of land into smaller parcels, and then often subsequent development. It's understood there were effects. This has effects on timber availability, wildlife habitat, water quality, recreational access, a number of different things. And so this was identified as a issue. And
Dr. Hibbert, can you just move the microphone a little closer?
You're fading. I'm sure.
Sure. Thank you.
And so the council wanted to take a look at this, kind of understand the economic, ecological, and social aspects of this issue. And you'll hear a little bit more about this at the end when Dr. Zemeta is going to talk about a working forest conservation initiative that the council is proposing. Second issue was impacts of biomass harvesting. Dr. Phillips, as mentioned before, who's going to talk on behalf of the site-level program, will be addressing this, but we are nearly completed the guidelines for harvesting of biomass. Harvesting guidelines are nearly completed, and he'll speak more to that in a minute. Water quality being the third issue, and mostly the relationship between forest cover and water quality. Fourth issue being forest health and invasive species. The council has recently produced a resolution addressing specifically emerald ash borer and some other invasive species as well, and Dr. Smet again will speak to that near the end of our presentation. And lastly, the effects of globalization, which is kind of a catch-all, has to do with the movement around of insects and diseases and invasive plants, so it has something to do with forest health, as well as economic issues. What are the ramifications on Minnesota forest products industry, among other things. A few of the recent accomplishments under the policy program area that the Forest Resources Council has partnered with groups to facilitate the execution of large-scale forest conservation easements. We've also provided staffing to the Governor's Forest Industry Task Force, both originally in 2003 when that was originally convened, as well as when it was reconvened last fall, and is which we helped in identifying kind of issues and what some of the short-term, make some short-term recommendations, which is in the governor's report. Also, the task force will be reconvened, or is in the process of being reconvened here, to look at more long-term issues. Third, provide advice to the governor related to federal roadless areas. The council felt this was a real good example of the importance of the council being able to come together, bring a lot of different interests, talking about and provide some advice to agencies and executives. A couple other of the recent policy accomplishments include providing advice to the governor, state and federal agencies regarding this emerald ash borer, which Dr. Zemeta will get into a little bit at the end of the presentation, as well as we've commissioned a pilot study to start looking at forest parcelization in northern Minnesota. We hear a lot of stories about what's going on, but try and actually quantify what's going on in the landscape. Another one of our programmatic areas, remember there were the three that Dr. Zemeta reviewed, first the policy program, also the landscape program. Landscape program, you can see here excerpts from the legislation, which calls for some long-range strategic planning and landscape coordination, as well as the formation of some regional forest resource committees. Landscape program was positioned to address kind of geographically unique resource issues, so looking at different regions, issues that are unique, or maybe solutions, which are strategies to get to certain conditions which are unique to different regions within the state, different forested regions. And so kind of their charge was twofold, developing sustainable forest resource plans for within each region, as well as establishing coordination groups of both private landowners and public land managers. And I'll get into a little more detail about what that entails. Here you can see the landscape planning administrative regions, 8 regions in the state, 6 major forested regions. There are no plans for the prairie area or the metro area, but all the major forested regions in the state, there's 6. You can see they mostly follow county borders, but also mirror ecological regions as well.
Sorry.
Landscape program. Accomplishments. The first part, of course, is producing these plans. All the plans were completed for the 6 major forested landscapes between 1998 and 2005, so they've all been completed at this point. And the different regions are in different various forms of implementing and trying to coordinate the activities prescribed for in the plans. To give you a little more of an idea what these plans look like, one, it's kind of an assessment of what's there, the economic, social, and ecological conditions within each region, ways in which the forest resource issues will be addressed, some strategies for achieving these desired future conditions, so what they want it to look like 50 to 100 years from now, and also strategies to coordinate management across forest ownerships. Because remember, this is kind of a checkerboard in some areas, the northern Minnesota, more public ownership. Some of the more southern landscapes, more private ownership, but still county, state, federal, and private land all mixed in there. And then the second step after the plans were developed was the implementation, just to give you a little better picture of what the implementation looked like. First, within each region, they developed some implementation committee projects. They coordinate and support projects by other partner organizations, which is a really important part of the program. Encourage consideration of the landscape level context, so thinking about all these issues within an entire landscape, both by landowners and land managers, as well as monitoring what's going on in each of those landscapes, activities, and outcomes. At this point, I'd like to let Dr. Phillips talk about the site level program with the council.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
And I guess maybe we'll take questions after the first 3 speakers.
Sure.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Mike Phillips. I'm the site-level program coordinator for the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and I'd like to use a little bit with my presentation, show and tell, kind of demonstrate what we've accomplished over the last, some of the stuff we've accomplished over the last few years within the program. Within the site level program, our first priority for the council when it was inaugurated back in 1995 was to develop a process for identifying guidelines as mandated in the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. The Act itself specifies specific attributes and outcomes that are to be accomplished in the guideline development. The Council was charged with coordinating the development. The Act also specifies that our guidelines have to be comprehensive and address soil, water, air, biotic, recreational, and aesthetic resources. That when they're developed, these are voluntary guidelines, that they need to be practical and sound based on the best available scientific information, integrated to minimize conflicting recommendations, and easy to understand and implement by resource managers, foresters, loggers, and landowners. Guideline development is not something that originated with the council. About 2 decades ago, we had some requirements, first under the Clean Water Act, the amendments, the 1987 amendments, and through funding to the DNR, we were mandated to develop water quality best management practices for forestry, mining, agriculture, and urban. So we developed our first set of guidelines through a collaborative approach of bringing the important organizations together and we published documents. In the early 90s, there was also a process that was put together, started by forest industry and the resort and tourism industries to try to resolve some visual quality issues. The counties and the state, et cetera, were brought into that process, and they put together a set of visual quality best management practices, which have been widely used throughout the United States. We still get a lot of calls from states that are interested in utilizing those specific guidelines.
Do you want to pass that around? Would that be all right?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
If you want to, okay.
Thanks, ma'am.
Also, in the early 90s, with the passage of the Wetland Conservation Act, we thought there were some things that needed to be adopted into our existing water quality best management practices to deal with protection. And thus, we organized a collaborative process, again, to develop another set of guidelines which incorporate our wetland practices. If you want to pass.
Thank you.
Sustainable Forest Resources Act passed, and council was organized, and like I said, the first thing we were asked to do was to put together a process for developing guidelines. And our first set of guidelines after 3 years a lot of intense activity, we developed what we used to call the mother of all guidebooks, which incorporated both our wetlands, water quality, and visual quality BMPs, and in addition, we developed specific guidelines for riparian zone management, wildlife habitat, soil productivity, and the protection of cultural resources. This was the first product of the council, which I again pass around. This is not a static process. As new information becomes available, as new information becomes available, we want to revise our guidelines based on that new information. And so almost from the inception, we decided that we need to identify where changes need to be made. We worked for about three to four years in revising the guidelines, and we published in 2005 the first revision to the guidelines.
The gold standard.
We call that the gold standard, yes. As part of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, when we develop guidelines, we're also supposed to undertake an economic assessment of the impacts of those guidelines. We've done that a number of times on a variety of issues. We've done some of it comprehensive, some of it not so comprehensive, but we're always looking at improving our economic evaluation of our guidelines. And Calder can speak more to that. That's out of my capability. But we're also supposed to explore opportunities for encouraging the application of those guidelines. So we have our guidelines, and the next thing we need to do is we need to identify whether we're using them or not. So one of the aspects of the program that's critically important is to develop a comprehensive monitoring program that gives us an opportunity to see the extent to which these guidelines are being adopted on all forest lands. We have a statewide monitoring program that's been undertaken. Actually, we've started it way back in the late 80s with our original BMPs, but we've done 6 years of monitoring for our existing guidelines. And basically, we evaluate their application on all land ownerships, non-industrial, private industrial, state lands, county lands, American Indian reservations, and on state lands. So it's a very comprehensive program. In addition, one of the areas that we need to continually look at is how we can improve the guidelines, and you can only do that by looking at effectiveness monitoring. Are these guidelines actually accomplishing our objectives when we're promoting them? Do they protect the resources as needed? We're also interested in forest resource monitoring. Some of the things that we've done, for example, the legislature gave the council a mandate not too long ago that we had to evaluate harvesting in riparian areas. We did 2 years of that monitoring and provided reports to the legislative committees and to all of the organizations involved in the council regarding the resource monitoring. That's a continuing, ongoing. Trends and conditions is very important. Let's see. Okay, I guess that covers it. I'm getting ahead of myself. Another part of it, we have the guidelines, we have monitoring, we have to encourage implementation, and you do that through training. And we've done a lot of partnering with, for example, the Minnesota Logger Education Program, with the University Extension Services in providing the training. One of the mandates under the SFRA was that we identify implementation goals, and that those and we had to be able to go out and evaluate whether we're accomplishing them. So we developed implementation goals, and we've actually gone out and collected information, which also has been provided to the legislature, on how well we're achieving our targets for education. Oh, back up a minute. Oops. One of the things that's important, I think within about 2 years of publishing the guidelines, we had provided training to more than 90% of the loggers in the state. So we think that's a pretty good record. In addition, I think we're at probably about 85%+ for all the resource professionals in Minnesota. So basically, if you can put all of these programs together, what you have is you have guideline development followed by training, followed by monitoring, followed by revision. It's an iterative process. It all builds on each other. And in between, you have effectiveness monitoring, which basically, like I said, tells us if our guidelines are actually working. So it's a never-ending process. It's not static. And we continue moving this process forward as new information becomes. Recent developments for guidelines. One of the things we've done in developing the guidelines, we've had in total 3 peer and public review processes in terms of reviewing our guidelines. And the area that's generated the most amount of interest is related to riparian zone management. And because of that, eventually in 2004, the council decided that it would put together a riparian science technical committee to address recent advances in science of riparian management, to inform basically decisions by the council for revising the riparian guidelines specifically. We've just completed this process of review, and we're putting together the findings for the council. Another big area is the biomass guideline development. We are statutorily required to develop biomass guidelines and approve those by June 30th of 2007. We have completed, through a collaborative process of bringing the groups together, we've developed our proposed guidelines, which are currently out for peer review. We expect to get those back by the end of February, and then they will immediately be available for public review. Following public review, we'll make revisions, propose them to the council, and have them approved by the end of June of this year. Again, we use a collaborative approach. And one thing I do like to point out is that these are the first of their type of guidelines anywhere in the United States. Most people have utilized biomass guidelines that fit in with their existing guidelines without looking whether or not they need to address additional concerns related to additional removal of biomass. And that's a lot of what we were looking at. And so I'm pretty pleased with where we've come with these guidelines. And I guess, so, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for listening. I will turn this back over to Dave Zemeta.
Why don't you stay put? We'll take a couple questions. That's fine.
Oh, okay.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Phillips, another topic related with forests that we've talked a great deal about the last 3 or 4 years is forest land certification.
Yes.
How does the certification program parallel what you're doing or use what you're doing, or what's the relationship between that certification program and the Forest Resource Council?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, thank you for that question. It's something I guess we should have covered. Certification is very critical, and one of the aspects of any certification, whether it be FSC,
Forest Stewardship Council.
Forest Stewardship Council or Sustainable Forestry Initiative, is that when you apply practices on the ground, you're required to implement the state practices. So when the audit teams come to the state to look at whether we're accomplishing our objectives for certification. When they're out in the field, what they look at is how well our guidelines are being implemented in the field. So it has a direct relation to both getting and maintaining certification.
All right, thank you. Did you have a question, Senator Bach?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I heard Dr. Phillips say that they have done some economic analysis on the guidelines, and if I could just build my base for a minute, Madam Chair, these guidelines are good stuff, and they're stuff that should be done out on the ground. And we ask the logging community out there that are doing the work on the ground for us on all of our public land and on private land to carry these out, do this harvesting, and you know, according to these guidelines. And then we give them no reimbursement for it at all. They absolutely just take it out of their bottom line, out of their checkbook, to do this work for us that we think is important. Now, they've been able to do that, and I think have done a pretty darn good job of it, and I think the monitoring will show that. The problem I think we're facing today is the mills most recently are starting to... It was that a logger would bid on a sale of wood, of course would bid the price of the guidelines in, and would then sell the wood to the mill. Well, now what's going on up north is the mills are starting to tell the loggers what they're willing to pay for wood. This is what we're going to pay you for the wood. I'm very concerned about where we're going relative to the guidelines with that, when all of a sudden the mills have squeezed the logger's price down so much that we start to see some avoidance of some of the guidelines because there just isn't enough money in the contract anymore to do it. And it's very serious right now. We've got a mill shut down up north, and if they reopen, they're going to reopen at a price that they dictate to the loggers. It's not the kind of market it was where wood is bid on, assuming that the guidelines are going to be in place. And I'm concerned about the direction that we're going. And so what I'm interested in from my question for Dr. Phillips is, I heard him say that they've done some economic analysis on at least all or some of the guidelines. I've never seen any of that information, and I think it would be helpful for this committee to know that if implementing these guidelines is a good idea, and I think it is, that somehow somebody ought to help the logging community carry them out when we know they're headed for real, they're in and headed for real tough sledding out in the woods. So if you could give me some idea what the economic analysis shows, and if you don't have it with you today, I'd certainly, if you could provide it to the committee, that would be helpful. But there is a cost to carrying this stuff out, and I think we can't ignore that.
Dr. Phillips?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, a couple of things. One, there, like I said, there have been a number of small reviews of the guidelines. The first one was with Dr. Visavage. We did that, I think, back in the mid-90s that looked at the guidelines. There were two studies that were done by Dr. Mike Kilgore from the University of Minnesota. And I think probably the study that's going to give us, I think, the clearest answer about the cost of guidelines is one that's currently underway with a gentleman from the Ukraine, a graduate student who is got, I think, six or seven loggers, and he is actually, for the first time, probably the best study of its kind I've ever seen. And it's actually looking at how the equipment moves on site and with and without the guidelines. So we're going to be able, it's a time and motion study. The results are probably, he's going to be looking at probably close to 120 to 140 sites over a year period of time. And we're going to get, I think, the first really comprehensive look at the cost of applying guidelines. But we don't have anything in place right now that can say, you know, absolutely that applying a filter strip or putting in the appropriate crossing structure cost this much. I think we're going to start getting to that answer when this study is completed and the analysis is in. It's a very good study.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could, if when the council has that, because they please provide it to this committee so that we can see that, because I think it's really important that we continue to get good compliance of the guidelines. And I think we have to honestly recognize it comes at a cost.
Good. All right, Dr. Zimetta, we'll let you.
I'd like to respond to Senator Bach. Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we are very, very conscious of the dire straits that the loggers are in up in northern Minnesota. And as Dr. Hibbert and I have been staffed to the governor's forest products industry task force and have seen a lot of this firsthand and talked with a lot of the loggers and the industry, mill workers and so on, who are adversely affected by this. And we're conscious that the economic impacts of the guidelines are a critical issue to address, particularly in these tough times. It's always been an issue, and it's been an issue for years, but it's especially urgent that we address this now. And we're glad that we have had the opportunity to do this time and motion study that Dr. Phillips was talking about, because it really is the first empirical research in Minnesota. I think we'll get a better idea of the actual costs than we've had heretofore, and we'd be happy to share that with the committee when the results are available.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have further comments? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Further comments.
Madam Chair, committee members.
Ask a quick question on that slide, please.
On this slide?
Yeah.
I'm about to address this slide.
Explain it first.
Yeah, let me explain it. A couple things before I get to it. I actually wanted to go, I'm sorry, back to this one for a minute. The biomass guideline development process, I wanted to mention that we are not only doing these biomass guidelines for timber harvest areas, forest land, but also the DNR, Divisions of Forestry, Wildlife, and Ecological Services requested us to take a lead role relative to development of biomass guidelines for open land and brushlands, which was a statutory mandate to the DNR by the 2005 legislature. So we have worked very closely with the Divisions of Forestry, Fish and Wildlife, and Ecological Services, loggers, experts in soil science from the University of Minnesota, and so on, to develop these guidelines. And so I wanted to make that clear, and we will have these done on time by June 30th of 2007, as the statute mandates us to do. And I'm really, really excited about this, because I was in a meeting yesterday with Washington office people from the Forest Service and experts from across the country. This is the first guidelines of this type that are going to be available in the United States for any of the 50 states, and I think they're going to get a lot of play elsewhere in the country as well as here in Minnesota.
So it's even more timely than it was when we passed this law 2 years ago, and we did that in anticipation of one biomass plant that sort of triggered this up north, which is great, but now we're talking about really, really moving fast on a lot of biomass development across our state and country. So this will be very helpful.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say Mr. Arnosti over here from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, a number of other folks played a critical role in making it possible for us to develop these guidelines. And we've gotten a lot of support from our council, Mr. Brandt, who's going to testify shortly, and a variety of diverse interests. And it has not been an easy process, but we've been able to move through it, I think, and reach a positive conclusion. Okay, the main reason I came here is to talk about our budget. Before I do that, I want to mention that the council is up for reauthorization. If the legislature doesn't reauthorize the council, it'll cease to exist on June 30th of 2007. So we're very interested in seeing the council reauthorized. The governor's budget recommends that the council be reauthorized and that the repealer at the end of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act be eliminated. I wanted to mention that in terms of all the things you've heard up till now, this annual report that you have in front of you is this 2006 annual report to the governor and the legislature. This is about a week old, so it's got a lot of very recent information in it, and we've just tried to summarize it in terms of this PowerPoint. But if you're interested in knowing what has the council done over the last year and previous years, what are you getting for the $730,000 that was expended on the council in FY06? It's in the annual report. Now, next year, the base budget request in the governor's budget is for $780,000, and that looks like an increase. But I want to explain that it's actually taking $50,000 that the DNR has expended on site-level monitoring and just moving it into the council's budget. So it's not really new money to us. It's money that the DNR had already been spending on site-level monitoring for the timber harvest and forest management guidelines, and we will continue to use it that way. But that's why there's a $50,000 increase in the budget. And I'm sure some folks from the DNR could explain this if you have questions about that. Now, this is our base budget. This is our operational budget. $780,000 is what's in the governor's recommended budget. And this amount was also recommended in the Forest Products Industry Task Force report recommendations. So I'll stop there for a minute and see if Senator Chaudhry has a question still.
Well, that was my question.
Did I explain it well enough, Senator? Okay. Now, in addition to our base budget, I covered everything here. We have a $200,000 budget request. This would be one-time funds in fiscal year 2008 for a working forest land conservation initiative. And I was asked to address this specifically, and I want to describe to you what this is. Now, you'll see in front of you there's a one-page handout on Forest Resource Council letterhead that goes into a little bit of detail on this Working Forest Land Conservation Initiative. Should be right under the annual report in your handouts there. Basically, there are three parts to this initiative. It's an assessment of the trends in forest parcelization, and what that means is the breaking up of larger forest parcels into smaller parcels as there's land sales. That is number one, and there's a huge amount of concern relative to this with the 7 million acres of private forest land in the state, particularly the 1 million acres that is industrial forest land or formerly industrial forest land, but also the other 6 million acres of what we call family forest land, or us old-timers called non-industrial private forest land. So we're trying to get a sense of what is going on relative to parcelization and then subsequent development of these forest lands. These lands are extremely important in terms of timber production, opportunities for hunting, birding, all sorts of recreation across northern Minnesota, central Minnesota in particular. And we oftentimes make assumptions about the degree to which this parcelization is occurring and then the subsequent development. What we're trying to do is ascertain what are the facts relative to this. How fast is it occurring where? And we have undertaken an initial study for Itasca County. We've used existing budget resources to look at the trends and drivers and effects of forest parcelization in Itasca County. That study is not ready for prime time yet, but it will be within the near future. What we're proposing in this $200,000 budget request is to extend that study beyond Itasca County to other forested regions of the state to get a better handle on exactly what is going on with parcelization and development and where are the major concerns. And that's number one. The second part of the study is looking at potential policy responses to this parcelization and development of private forest land. We want to identify what are the tools, the policy tools in the toolbox available to the legislature in particular relative to private forest land conservation. And there are a number of them listed on this sheet. You see that there's fee title ownership, like the DNR administers 5.3 million acres of forest land. That's what I mean by that. There's large-scale conservation easements. And last year I testified several times to different committees on behalf of the governor's budget requests for $10 million in large-scale conservation easements. And the legislature appropriated $7 million and another $500,000 from the LCMR. And we certainly appreciated that. Some concerns were raised, and legitimate concerns in my view, about the amount of money that might be requested in the long run for conservation easements. Senator Bach, in particular, and we had conversations about this, and Representative Dill on the House side. And that is really the genesis of this study. It wasn't that we dreamed this up as a bunch of state people, but rather we were asked to work on this by some key legislators like Senator Bach. Some other things that need to get looked at, other tools in the toolbox, tax policy, property tax, estate tax. These have implications relative to whether forest land is retained, whether it's divided, and how it gets managed in the future. Financial assistance programs, technical assistance programs, education and information programs, awareness programs for private landowners. And then planning and zoning, which are dirty words to a lot of people, but it's very important that we take a look at that as options, because good planning and with forestry as a component of it has the potential to address some of these concerns, at least in some places. And then a variety of other policy approaches, looking across the United States at what has worked in other states and what might be feasible to look at here in Minnesota. So the lion's share of the study would be focused on looking at these different policy tools and how applicable are they here in Minnesota. One thing I want to emphasize is we're housed over at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus, and Calder and I both have PhDs in forest policy. We would do some of this work in-house. We'd also contract out for additional work. But the key thing I want to emphasize is a lot of money has already been spent looking at some of these issues. Previous University of Minnesota research, also the Blandin Foundation currently has a $50,000 study that they're doing on the Sustainable Forestry Incentives Act, which is an act that's passed by the legislature back in 2001 to try to promote private forest land conservation and retention. And we will build on this existing research. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We're not asking for the moon here. We're asking for the additional funds that we think we need to fill in the rest of the information so that we can make sound recommendations to the legislature. Then finally, we would make recommendations to decision makers, and particularly the legislature, to gain a better understanding of the magnitude of these issues with parcelization and development of the private forest land, range and cost effectiveness of possible policy approaches, and integrated solutions that recognize the complexity of the problem. When you start getting into taxation, for example, there's a lot of strings attached to that. And Dr. Hibbard has a master's degree in forest taxation here in Minnesota and a PhD in forest policy and economics. So we're pretty well set to look at some of these issues. Then finally, the important roles and responsibilities of city, county, state, and federal governments, as well as private organizations in the retention of these working forests. So that gives you a sense, I think, of the study that we're proposing, the $200,000 one-time budget request. So One of the things that we recognize is there's quite likely to be a major bonding request coming before the legislature for large-scale forest conservation easements. Senator Saxog and I were talking about this the other day. We want to make sure that we have recommendations prior to the 2008 session, or at least at the beginning of the session, relative to conservation easements. So even though the money may not be available till July 1 of 07, our intent is to use existing resources to jumpstart this study to make sure we have at least a draft of recommendations on conservation easements in time to have an influence on the 2008 bonding requests that are likely to come forward. Okay, in addition to this $200,000 one-time request, there's a second $200,000 one-time request. And this relates to the next handout that you have. It's called the Research Advisory Committee background sheet that you see in front of you. The first page of that is what's in the law. This is out of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act in 1995. 89A.08, Research Advisory Committee. And it describes who's on this committee. Heretofore, it was the College of Natural Resources. Now it has a new name. It's basically the same entity, the Natural Resources Research Institute up in UM Duluth, the what's now called the Northern Forest Experiment Station, the main research branch of the U.S. Forest Service, and then the Department of Natural Resources, other organizations as appropriate. Well, and this Research Advisory Committee has a variety of statutory mandates. I won't read through them. They're listed here. And some assessment work that was required to do, and some other things you can see in terms of the legislation. If you turn over the page, you can see there's a history to this Research Advisory Committee. There were a number of entities put on this back in 1996 when it was first formed. The legislature provided quite a bit of resources back to the Forest Resources Council in the early years in 96, 97, and about $280,000 was used for forest resources research. This leveraged about $1 million in other contributions from federal, other state, private sources for research related to the main concerns of the council in terms of looking at economic and social aspects of forest resources, trying to understand ecosystem function and integrity, and so on. From 1999 to 2001, the Research Advisory Committee met periodically to monitor research expenditures and outcomes. Committee has not met since the fall of 2001, and the reason for that is there have been no funding. The chair of my council, Dr. Al Sullivan, who works for President Brunix at the university, at that time was dean of the College of Natural Resources at the U of Minnesota, and he chaired this Research Advisory Committee at the time. And he and his counterparts decided if there's no funding available, there wasn't much point in meeting. So that's why it hasn't met for the last 5 years. For the first time since the late 90s, there's a potential opportunity now for the Research Advisory Committee to receive state funding. The governor's budget includes this $200,000 one-time request. And where this is coming from is the governor's forest products industry task force identified a number of research needs related to wood fiber, the way wood fiber is priced, the way base prices are set for sales by the DNR, the different counties, the U.S. Forest Service, and then also best practices for setting up and administering timber sales on public lands, history of timber market corrections, and so on. You can see down on the bottom of page 2. These are direct quotes from the governor's task force report. So that is the reason this is before you as a $200,000 one-time appropriation to address some of these high-priority research needs. I'd be remiss if I didn't say there are also other research needs that $200,000 probably wouldn't be adequate to address, some of these long-term riparian science research needs and so on. So I just mention that as a matter of fact. I think I've covered a couple other things I didn't mention is looking at research on value-added manufacturing, conducting research to support adoption of improved logging technology. These are other potential research topics that were raised in the Governor's Forest Products Industry Report. Before I get to the thank you and the questions, there's one other item that I need to mention. Before, given the timing with appearing before this committee, my chair, Al Sullivan, sent a letter to Senator Anderson, and there's a similar letter to Senator Chaudhry. You'll see you have a special letter in front of you as the chair of the Environment and Natural Resource Policy Committee. What this is a resolution that was passed by the Forest Resources Council on January 24th related to invasive species, and in particular to an exotic insect species from Asia called the emerald ash borer. And there's a great deal of concern on the part of virtually all of my council members. There were a couple that weren't at this meeting, so they didn't vote in favor of this because they weren't there. But there's concern that's virtually unanimous on the council about this, or perhaps unanimous. This exotic invasive insect species called the emerald ash borer has no known, there's no way to control this. There's no biological control mechanisms that are known. It was introduced into the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, has just decimated the ash resources in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, in the Detroit area, and increasingly across the Lower Peninsula. It's been found in Chicago. One record of it up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. There's a huge amount of concern on the part of the state of Wisconsin. It hasn't been found there yet, but it's probably more a matter of when than if. And likewise, there's a very great concern on the part of a whole array of federal and state agencies here in Minnesota. So we wanted to bring this to your attention. What the resolution that the council passed does supports the allocation of appropriate funding to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources for implementing firewood restrictions on DNR-administered lands. There's some folks here from DNR who can speak to the details of that if you want to hear more. And also appropriate funding to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for an invasive species survey and inspection program. This is very critical in terms of trying to get early warning if this emerald ash borer appears in Minnesota, to be ready and to respond quickly. And the Minnesota Department of Agriculture plays a critical lead role relative to that. Also recommends that following the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's lead, the state should continue to augment invasive species surveys and integrated pest management strategies. And then finally, the resolution, which also went to the governor, I should mention, and to the commissioners of agriculture and natural resources, as well as you key legislative committee chairs, that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the DNR should convene a meeting or meetings to discuss the need for coordination with nearby states and provinces, encourage implementing a ban on unapproved firewood on all lands in the state, tribal, private, federal, state, and county-administered lands, and identify action steps for rapid interagency response to the introduction of emerald ash borer and other likely invasive species, including appropriate funding sources. So there's more detail on this in the resolution itself, but I wanted to summarize this for you, take advantage of the opportunity that I'm before you today to present this to you, and just stress the urgency of this. Similar letters went to the lead people in the USDA Forest Service research branch here in Minnesota, state and private forestry branch here in Minnesota, and the Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service, which plays a very important role relative to invasive species from the federal side, not only here in the state, but nationwide. And now I'll stop and be happy to entertain questions.
Senator Saxhog, thank you, Dr. Zemeta.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Zemeta, you mentioned conservation easements several times. and not Forest Legacy by name, but that's, you know, that's what was bonded for last year. And the Forest Legacy people put out a number of costs, you know, in connection with the amount of money that they asked for. In your assessment, are you gonna kind of redo that, reaffirm that? Do you kind of agree with the assessment that's been put out so far?
Senator Saxog, Madam Chair, I don't want to prejudge the results of our study. If we are funded to do this $200,000 study, what we want to do is approach it with an open mind. Look at what the situation is here in Minnesota. Look at large-scale conservation easements as an important tool in the toolbox. And as I said, I testified three times last year and actually got an award from the Nature Conservancy for some of the work that I did related to this, a government relations award, you know, as you did, didn't you?
I did, Madam Chair, Dr. Zubeda, as with many of the things that we're dealing with, and I digress to the dedicated funding, we've got kind of a ballpark figure on what we might glean out of the constitutional amendment, but we haven't got down to the fine tuning. And I'm kind of looking at what you're going to be doing is getting down to the fine tuning on all the things you list here, and I think it's a great list.
Thank you.
All right. Who is Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Dr. Zumeta, I'd like to talk just a second about the Research Advisory Committee and the request for $200,000.
Yes.
Before we pass a budget out of here, I'm sure we're going to be looking at every place we can to prioritize expenditures, and we'll be short of money from what we want to do. Could you prioritize the activities for us and put a dollar amount on those at some time, so that if we did not have $200,000 to allocate to that, if we would find out what we would receive in return for half of that amount or two-thirds of the amount? And I don't expect you to do it now. It's just a request of you.
I can give you at least a preliminary indication of what I think are the most important items, but I want to put a caveat in there. I was staff to the governor's forest products industry task force, and the items that are listed here are directly out of the task force report. What I'm referring to is on the two-page handout at the bottom of page two, items A through E that are listed there. And the task force itself did not list these necessarily in priority order, but assuming there's always budget constraints, and there will be. I mean, even with the $200,000, that's not going to be adequate to address all of these items. So the most urgent, in my personal view, is analyzing ways to price wood fiber and set base prices for sale on all ownerships, which is the paragraph above this A through E. That was also from the governor's task force report. That's critically important. And there's some work already underway using existing funds, as I understand it, from Department of Employment and Economic Development with Dr. Kilgore at University of Minnesota and the Department of Forest Resources. Now, I'm not familiar with the exact amounts and exactly what the status of that work is, but I know that that is getting addressed because of the urgency of the situation relative to the forest industry and the loss of logging infrastructure in northern Minnesota. And then the second piece is A, identify and recommend best practices for setting up and administering timber sales on public lands. That one is extremely important as well, because there are certainly some things we can learn by looking at the way this gets done in other states across the country, the way historically timber sales have been done here in Minnesota, and there's always room for improvement. And again, I don't want to prejudge, you know, what the results of that might be, but those are very high priority issues for research in my personal view.
Senator Senator Frederick.
Madam Chair, Dr. Zimetta, it strikes me that three or four of these, maybe all of them, but three or four in particular, would be of interest to the industry as well, like the history of timber market conditions, conduct stumpage market and management economic analysis, research and value-added manufacturing. Might there be an opportunity to leverage some private funding to match the federal funding if we would say a one-to-one match on $150,000, that you'd end up with $300,000 to do the research?
Senator Frederickson, Madam Chair, I don't want to speak on behalf of the industry. Mr. Brandt is here, and I think will be speaking shortly, and I'll let him respond to that. He's one of my council members.
Is that fair enough? Thank you.
Those are good questions, Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, it's the first year that I've chaired a budget division. I'm just trying to figure out where all this one-time money is going to come from, because I've already spent it in my ag department.
You can't have spent my money in your committee, Senator Vickerman.
On a serious note, I want to do all I can for ag, and we're going to do some things, but my main driver is going to be renewable energy. I've put several million in there over what the governor wants, because I think that's going to be the economic development and everything out where I live, because we don't have any trees to cut down anyway. So I think we need to all work. So I'm just a little bit concerned if everybody's coming for one-time money is going to be gone.
Yeah, and the governor has $21 million or something. Is that all one time? In forest management in general, and I don't know how it all breaks down to. Can you answer that? Well, sorry, I don't want to put you on the spot. He'll answer in a few minutes, I think. But it's a lot of money. And some of that is from different accounts. Not all of it is general fund money, and some of it's one time, and I think some of it's ongoing. So we haven't really had a chance to go through that budget yet, because we haven't had the DNR here to present the whole budget recommendation. So we'll get into that in more detail. Those are very, very good questions that your members are asking. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Dr. Zanata, have you thought about, is there any way that we can increase the participation in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act? There's something we can do, because I think that would help with this parcelization issue if we could get more participation.
Senator Bach, Madam Chair, I was speaking at some length yesterday with Senator Chaudhry's staff person, and I suggested to her that Dr. Kilgore, who's doing a study, as I mentioned, that the Blandin Foundation has funded, a $50,000 study on the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act. He's going to present on Monday in Dr. Chaudhry's committee. And I suggest to he's got a number of recommendations in there that I think have a lot of merit. I went to a overview of that earlier this week right here in this building. And there's some very interesting results that he's going to present. And then I'm going to follow his presentation with some more detail on this $200,000 working forest land study. But I'd suggested to Senator Chaudhry's staff person that Dr. Kilgore should go first, because what he's doing is directly relevant that we'd like to build on relative to potential improvements in the SFIA.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bach.
It might be helpful for counsel to explain to the committee what the SFIA is for members that might not know.
That's a good idea. Can you help us, Ms. Baker? Mr. Knopf, whoever wants to. Go ahead.
Is it here?
Ms. Baker. Well, go ahead, Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, the details of the SFIA may escape me a little bit. It's been a few years, and I know it was done mostly in the tax. Much of the work on that bill was done in the tax committee, but that's the Incentive Act that provides incentives for landowners to continue their land in forestry, especially for private landowners and industrial land, not just the non-industrial, but the industrial too. And if I remember right, there's a certain acreage above a point where they have to leave it open to the public taking of game and fish and other activities, but actually, Mr. Zimetta may have a better understanding of the technical details of the act. But it's basically an incentive program that provides a tax incentive for landowners to continue their land in forestry.
Correct.
Do you want to add? Okay, Dr. Zanotto.
No, that's basically correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe the property owner has to have a forest stewardship plan on the property, and then I believe they have to actually put a covenant on their title that says for a period of 8 years, not less than 8 years, that they won't subdivide or develop the property. So that the intent is to have a tax incentive to keep land working for forestry purposes. So we have about a million acres enrolled in Minnesota.
So it's not like a permanent easement. It's a short-term covenant. But the tax break, is that a one-time thing?
It's once a year. The Department of Revenue contacts the property owner to make sure that they're still complying with the covenant. And then if that property owner responds back, that property owner receives a check from the Department of Revenue for, I think right now it's, I don't know how it's calculated, but I think it's slightly over $4 an acre as an incentive, you might say, to kind of buy down their property taxes to create so that the property tax burden doesn't become the driver that causes the parcelization or the development of the property. It's a very good program, but it's very underutilized. And Senator Scoia and I have talked in the tax committee that we're interested in some ways where we maybe could increase the participation in that. So I'm interested in talking to Dr. Kilgore. Yeah.
Senator Bach, Madam Chair, it's $5.24 an acre. You said over four. You're right, but it's a little higher than that in the last year, in 2006. And I would suggest, if you can, see Dr. Kilgore's presentation on Monday. You'll find it, you know, very compelling. And I think there's a lot of good recommendations in there. One of the interesting things is the importance of hunting to these private landowners. I mean, something like 46% of the people that Dr. Kilgore surveyed, that was their prime reason for owning forest land. So I think you're going to find this a very interesting presentation on Monday.
I think probably half of us on this committee are on Senator Chaudhry's committee as well, so a lot of us will be there for sure. And everyone else, I'm sure, is welcome. Senator Chaudhry.
Definitely. We're going to delve into this Working Forests Initiative in detail on Monday, and I think this is one of the most critical issues of our decade. I've got lots of policy questions about what the loss of all this acreage could do to global warming, climate change in our state, and other long-range issues. So you mentioned the bonding committee, and I'm wondering, from a finance committee point of view, whether it'd be good to have the bonding committee hear from these folks this session as kind of a preview to what's coming up. I think we really need to build up the urgency of the matter.
Dr. Zumeta, just on a different topic, I just want to ask, if you can just give us sort of a two-minute overview of where your base budget goes, your $730,000 a year. You know, how many staff do you have? How is that mostly staff that accounts for that budget?
Madam Chair, committee members, if you look inside the front cover of our annual report, you'll see the listing of our staff. I'm the executive director. I'm full-time. Dr. Phillips, the guideline development monitoring coordinator, he's full-time. Lindbergh Eckel is a landscape program manager. He is full-time. Dr. Hibbard, who you heard from earlier, the policy analyst, is full-time. Dr. Clarence Turner works for us 50% time. And Leslie McEninley, our information assistant, who actually is here with us today, at the moment is 25%. I think that's right. Is that right? 25%. But in light of the workload we're facing, we're in the process of increasing her time on a temporary basis up to 80%. And some of that relates to workload with the governor's task force report preparation, and some of it relates to just anticipating what's coming with if we get some or all of these one-time budget requests and the urgency of working on the conservation easement issues and so on. I would say of our $730,000 budget, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but somewhere in the low $400,000 range is our salary and fringe. So by far the lion's share of the budget goes toward the staff. Recognize a highly educated, very experienced staff. And as far as the rest of the expenditures, the site level program is the biggest program in terms of budget expenditures. The landscape program and the policy program somewhat or slightly smaller than the site level program. But basically all three of those programs are you know, extremely important, and the money is sort of balanced between them. And there's a number of other statutory mandates to the council, I should add, that just haven't been funded since, you know, the council in 1996 received over $1 million. Last year we had $730,000, and you think about the 10 intervening years with inflation eroding the budget, that's just the way it's been, and we've dealt with it, and I think accomplished a great deal with the resources that we've been appropriated. And frankly, I'm very appreciative to the legislature for the support that the council's received, you know, over the last 5-plus years that I've been executive director, and really since its inception. I think it's a very positive thing that we still exist and that we've been able to do all that we've been able to do.
And you, all those handbooks that you passed around, those are all your publications? Or, I mean, do you sell those or just give those away, or how does that work?
I'm going to ask Dr. Phillips to answer that, sure. if you would.
Madam Chair, the ones that belong to the council would be the mother of all guidebooks, the green one, the big green one, and the gold standard. The others were produced by the DNR with input from the forestry community, but it was funded through the legislature.
Okay. So the two newer ones. So you put those together, had them published, and are they distributed widely?
Madam Chair, the first publication, the Green Book, I think we distributed somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 to 8,000 copies. The gold standard, as I like to call it, we have printed 4,000 copies and distributed about half of them to date.
You've never charged anyone for those?
Madam Chair, no. As a matter of fact, the two things we don't do is we don't charge for the guidebooks, and we haven't copyrighted the material, because we're trying to encourage, if people wish to use it, that they should have the flexibility to use and copy whatever they want out of the guidebook if it promotes protection of the resources.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, also we want to make sure that the loggers in particular, but also private landowners, have access to this information, and charging for it might be an impediment to getting wide use of it. So we're very, very sensitive and to the challenges that the loggers face these days. I mean, we're trying to do what we can to avoid undue administrative burdens on those folks.
Madam Chair, if I could have one last comment regarding the guidelines. The biomass guidelines that are going to be approved will be an insert that will be added to the gold standard, and we will be sending that out to be inserted into the guidebook once they are published.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, thank you. If there's no other question, we better get on to the rest of the testifiers today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's bring up Mr. Wayne Brandt, please. You're representing the forest industry. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Brandt. I'm Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries and Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Minnesota Timber Producers members are loggers, small sawmillers, allied businesses from throughout the state. Minnesota Forest Industries members are primary manufacturers of forest products based here in Minnesota. I don't know about the members of the committee, but all those doctors, $730,000 a year, if that's not the best deal in health, or at least forest health that we've got, I don't know where else we could find a better deal. So we're pleased and strongly supportive of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act and the activities of the council. I won't belabor the doctors all covered the bulk of what I was going to say. I do think that some of the questions are right on point, and I think this is a program that can stand up to the scrutiny of just what is the value that the citizens of the state, the taxpayers of the state, get for this expenditure of funds and these activities. A couple of things just to fill in on the previous presenters. The council itself, which I serve on, forms an important leadership function on a whole broad range of sustainable forestry issues, and particularly is a forum where the disparate interests get together, the 17 different folks, including myself, from 17 different perspectives get together and talk about and resolve problems and concerns in a pretty effective manner on forestry issues. Get a lot of progress made on things rather than just dumping them here for a series of set piece battles in front of elected officials or in the courts. So I think that's been very positive. One item in the actual Sustainable Forest Resources Act, you'll see the Forest Resources Partnership mentioned. It is not a government activity, although agencies of government are in there. They have performed some effective roles, and the partnership members are public and private landowners, land managers, and loggers. And it's kind of one of the on-the-ground groups to look at these issues. As the guidelines have been developed, they've all signed on the dotted line on different memoranda of understanding to support the implementation of those guidelines. And presently, they're in the process of putting together a conference on forest productivity, which will be held next month. So there's not any money in the SFRA budget for that, but that's an important activity. The guidelines, you've heard a lot about the guidelines. I would just say that today's a good day to be out in the woods. It's cold, it's crisp, it's clear, and those guidelines are being used today on every logging job, virtually every logging job in the state, as loggers and land managers are working on those projects. The monitoring that that Dr. Phillips described, these are voluntary guidelines. They've been set up that way, put together that way. But without monitoring, both in terms of compliance and effectiveness, it's just conversation. I mean, if we didn't have a monitoring program that we could demonstrate, and we, the entire forestry community, could demonstrate that we're actually using these guidelines, show where, how, when they're being used, and then include the effectiveness portions, then it's just the book, and the book doesn't do anybody any good unless the book gets used, the gold standard, the mother of all guidebooks, and all of the various ones that that Mike referred to. So monitoring, and the funds on monitoring is a key component to this activity. Within the monitoring area of statute, there's another program that we're pretty proud hasn't gotten much use in the dozen years, and that's the citizen complaint process. The council maintains a program, an 800 number website access for people that have concerns about logging practices, forest management practices. They can call and register complaints. We get a few a year. There are 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 logging jobs every year statewide, and we get some every year. And so that's an important program, too, where people have got concerns that they've got a place to go, and they can get those concerns explained, addressed, or, not everybody's perfect out there in the woods, and sometimes the right things aren't done. And so we try and get them rectified through that. On the landscape program, The council has not been, this is a real citizens-based program. The council has not been directive to those citizens that involve themselves in the landscape program. The council did not, and I have served on the landscape committee of the council for a number of years. You know, we didn't tell the citizens that are showing up with their own time and their own money and own goodwill, this is how you're to do a landscape project, a landscape plan, a landscape coordination effort. Provided staffing, provided suggestions, but frankly, you know, the citizens in the northern part, the far northern part, have a different view of the world than those in the west central, than those in the southeast. So all of those landscape plans have similar parts, but they're all a little different because the citizens in the regions are all a little different here in our state. In terms of the impact of that, you can see out of these landscape documents portions of those, their goals, their objectives, their priorities that show up in part of the Forest Service plans and part of the DNR management plans and part of the county management plans. A lot of that activity would probably end up having to be replicated somewhere else if it wasn't done through this program. The research activities, we think that those are two very important. The two 200,000 one-time projects we think are very important projects, particularly the one on maintaining the forest land base. I would agree with Senator Chaudhry that that is one of the biggest issues on the environment and sustainability facing us of the decade. And having that information pulled together back in front of particularly this committee as a finance committee's hands, so you can look at, along with the policy committees, the bonding committees, where do we get the best bang for the buck? You know, if we're going to invest X number of millions of dollars a year, where does it make the most sense for those programs to be placed on the ground, and what's the mix of those programs where we get the best results? So that's an important thing. One of the things that was not touched on very extensively, the interagency information cooperative, which is in the statute, and while Senator Bach and Senator Saxhog and myself all know that the three T's are timber, tourism, and taconite of our northern economy, the three T's of the IIC are the tools, the techniques, and the technology transfer. Putting these best tools, be they modeling, be they calibrations, be they other scientific research, and getting them out to the practitioners, the counties, the individual landowners, is something that it's an area where I think we can make another step on sustainable management. I guess finally, in terms of the programs in the SFRA, the continuing education and certification, as Dr. Kilgore cited, Minnesota Logger Education Program, my organization's funded the establishment of those a dozen years ago. They're separate now completely from us. And, you know, we're pretty proud that, you know, over 90% of the wood that's harvested in the state is by loggers that have gone through that training. And I would note that it's annual training. It's 3 days of training, three complete days on an annual basis, which I think might be more than the bar requires for attorneys to maintain their license. I'm not positive, but I think it's right in there. So
3 days, that's what it is.
What it is for?
3 years, 3 days and 3 years for an attorney.
To do, yeah.
Yeah.
But our standard is triple the bar standard.
Right.
And we're proud of that. We also have completed the first group of master logger certified loggers through that program. It's an add-on program. They're actually here at the Capitol on Tuesday. David Refkin from Time Magazine, which has been a leader in pushing for certification programs, was here to recognize those contractors. So that's important. I guess, you know, and I said it a little bit, you know, in jest at the start, you know, gee, all these doctors for $730,000, there's a lot of bang for the buck on sustainable forestry in these programs. We're proud of the sustainable forestry that's practiced here in Minnesota, the role that the SFRA, the council plays, and my members are proud of the role that we play. We as a state have been a leader worldwide on sustainable forestry. We continue to be a leader today. And on behalf of my members, you know, it's our commitment that we'll continue to do our part so that Minnesota continues to be the leader on sustainable forestry practices. You know, we want, my members want what we think all Minnesotans want in this area. We want to see healthy and secure forests. We want to see sustainable forestry practices on the ground. And we want to see a healthy and secure forest-based economy. So that's, again, our commitment, and we'll do our part. Happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much. Question, Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brandt, for a few years, as we heard in testimony, the Research Advisory Committee has not been active because it has been funded. And there's a request for funding for $200,000 this year. Would industry or any of the folks that you represent, would they be willing to match some of the money that the state may put into that program to get it operational again?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, as long as it doesn't come out of my association budget. You know, we have, as an industry, have participated both with people and financially in a number of research activities through the years. We think that research is very important. We've helped fund research on goshawk populations, on boreal owl populations. Our members have been some of the on-the-ground practitioners in the area of riparian management. So, you know, we've done a lot of that. So it's not a question that's been posed to us before, so I don't have a specific answer other than to say that, you know, we, you know, have put our own dollars very frequently into research activities.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Brandt? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it. Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Brandt, on the emerald ash borer issue, how will this potentially affect your industry?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, while ash is not one of the predominant species that we use, I think only about 60,000 cords out of 4 million on an annual basis are ash. You know, we are very concerned about the movement of all of these invasive pests into the state. Be it the Asian longhorn beetle, the gypsy moth, the emerald ash borer, they all have impacts. We work very closely with the Department of Agriculture, Mr. Friso, who was here earlier, on those topics and want to, you know, see them contained. We don't, you know, want to see invasive pests knocking down our resource. You know, if you go back just a few short years, the end of the 1990s, the spruce budworm, which is a cyclical pest here in the state, took out and removed nearly one-third of the entire balsam resource in the state of Minnesota. One-third, and that's one of the most important species for wildlife, for thermal cover, for making paper. These pests have a potential to have a significant impact on us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Eric Reed. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes.
Good. All right.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Eric Reed with the Nature Conservancy. For having me here and for considering reauthorization for MFRC. The Nature Conservancy, our primary mission is to protect habitat through conservation. We do that primarily through acquisitions and easements. We're also starting to look into threats such as invasive species and climate change, and so that's a new area of interest for us. We've got a 50-year history, and it's pretty significant change for us. So some of the testimony you've heard earlier today is addressing at least invasive species. We do a lot of our work with partners, and MFRC has been a primary partner in the Forest Legacy movement. And as Dr. Zemeta mentioned, both he and Senator Saxog received an award from the Nature Conservancy for their efforts in championing Forest Legacy this last session. And I'd also like to point out that some of the partnership that we've got with MFRC is on their council. Our former board chair, Paige Weinberger, sits on the council, and then also their chair, Al Sullivan, is on our board. So there's a good interconnectedness between the Nature Conservancy and the Forest Resources Council. On Monday, I believe, the Senator Chaudhry's committee will be viewing the history of the land, Part 5, and that's an excellent representation of forest parcelization and the dire need that's out there for protecting our northern forest lands. And that's something that the Minnesota Forest Legacy Partnership, of which both the Nature Conservancy and the Forest Resources Council, our members, have been really pushing to draw attention to. And it was all started by a Blandon Foundation grant of $6 million to the Nature Conservancy. And we've committed to raise another $6 million in private funds, so for a total of 12, to put into that effort. But it's really just the start. And so we're really excited that the Forest Resources Council is interested in looking at policy options as well, other tools in the toolbox to help address forest parcelization. Because we can throw a whole lot of money at this, and it's going to need a whole lot of money, even no matter what we come up with as far as policy options, to protect some of these lands. And I'd also add that they play a critical role in sustainable forest management. The books that you've seen here and have great names to them are real important tools that are out there in the field and utilized heavily. Mr. Brandt had mentioned the quality of the staff. And I used to work for the Minnesota Conservation Corps. And we were up for elimination from the state budget a couple years in a row. And the toll that that takes on morale is something that I have personally experienced. And in my experience, a lot of the staff got recruited away. And so these folks are facing a pink slip on June 30th. And so I would urge you to move this through quickly and retain these quality individuals doing the good work that they're doing. And with that, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? All right. Thank you so much. And finally, Mr. Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I do have a fact sheet to hand out if it's due right now. My name is Matthew Norton. I do the forestry and wildlife advocacy for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Forestry is the main subject area that I'm responsible for at MCEA, although many of you may know me from discussions of off-highway vehicles. I won't be talking about those today. I have a background in forestry. I got a master's in forest science from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and I've been working on forestry issues in Minnesota for the past 5 years for MCEA. And I want to reiterate some of the things that have been said earlier by Mr. Reed and Mr. Brandt, and that is very strong support for the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and the work that it has done, its staff, on frequently a very tight, too tight budget. The function of the council has been addressed a couple of times, and I think that Mr. Brandt accurately described it as a place where disparate interests and views come together to try to address very difficult problems with in the area of forest resources. And the function of the council is to fulfill some of the promises in the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, namely that when we engage in major timber harvest in the state, that we take appropriate steps to study the effects of timber harvest, and we take the steps necessary to protect all of the values that Minnesota forests hold for the people of the state. MCEA has served on the Forest Resources Council since its inception. My board member, Jan Green, has been the council member, and both she and I have served on various committees of the Forest Resources Council. So we do support reauthorization of the council. We do not think, however, as you'll see in the number one item on that fact sheet, that the repealer provision should be repealed. We would support extending the sunset date out for 5 or 7 years as you see fit. The purpose is that having a sunset provision serves in terms of oversight, legislative oversight. We also support the request for additional funds for the research programs that have been identified today by Dr. Zemeta. We're very happy that there is a resolution supporting the study of non-native invasive species and the enormous danger that they represent to the industry in the state, not only the primary forest product sector, but also the secondary sector, which accounts for about four times the gross state product that the primary forest product sector produces, and of course also for the ecology of the state forests and the social functions that they serve. There are a couple of additional needs, however, that the Forest Resources Council has in terms of funding. These are very serious needs. They could not be more timely, particularly in the subject of biomass. The site-level biomass guidelines that have been produced do not answer all of the questions, and there are major questions that remain unanswered. And the team working for the Forest Resources Council that put those biomass guidelines together acknowledges this. They have prepared a list of important questions that do need to be answered. 100, 120, 130 years ago, as the major timber companies in the state looked at the forest resources that were standing at that time, particularly the great pineries of the east, central, and the northern regions of the state, saw a huge potential and for exploitation. And indeed, those resources built much of the country and a lot of the wealth in this state. Right now, I believe that there is a similar enthusiasm for biomass harvest. And it would be a very good idea for the legislature to ensure that the Forest Resources Council looks carefully at all of the effects that are attendant in biomass harvest, particularly from forested areas of the state. We have real concerns, and I think that they're shared by many of the scientific advisors to the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, that some of these questions be answered so that we don't make mistakes that harm our resources. The number two item on the fact sheet addresses the landscape program, which has been discussed a little bit already today. The landscape programs, as Wayne Brandt described them, are a cooperative venue to try to reach the desired future forest conditions identified by citizens, citizen stakeholders, in each of the six regions of the state. And just as the implementation and compliance monitoring is necessary to make sure that the guidelines that the Forest Resources Council has produced are effective and being used out on the landscape, the landscape implementation committees need help that the council and the landscape program specifically provide them in gathering data about how the forest is changing as a result of management activities across different ownerships and assessing what that means in terms of whether the forest conditions are moving in the direction that those landscape committees have set in terms of the desired objectives. So I hope that if you have any questions regarding the advisability of providing the funds to answer these existing statutorily established questions that the council has to answer, that you would direct some of those questions not just to me, but to the council staff that are here today, the panel of doctors behind me. And with that, I gladly take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, Mr. Norton, hang on. We're just looking at your sheet here and want to clarify the two requests that you're talking about. Are these above and beyond the governor's recommendations? Do you know?
They are above and beyond.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct. The council has had, given the scope of its duties, a very limited budget. It was limited years ago when it was set at roughly $730,000. It's bounced around a little bit, not very much. And to steal a phrase from the first President Bush, the silent thief of inflation has really eroded the ability of that $730,000 to do the work that the council has before it.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Norton? Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who really would like to be heard at this time to fill in? We're not asking for it, but all right. Members, I'm going to, and obviously, as I mentioned, we're going to hear, we still haven't heard the entire DNR budget recommendations, the other major state agencies. We've just begun that process, frankly. So we have a lot of work to do in the next few weeks, and I don't know if we're going to, who said meeting Saturdays? Did someone say that? Did Senator Pogamiller say that?
Yes,
I thought he
yeah.
did on the Senate floor. So I'm not threatening that, but we're going to have to work hard. We'll see. Let's just say we'll see. He said, well, would you rather work Saturdays now or Saturdays later? And I know the real answer, both, right?
That's what we really either. Just get it done in our days here.
So get ready. I do want to say I've tried to meet with all the committee members individually, privately, to talk about your wish list or your highest priorities would be for funding. And if I haven't had a chance to meet with any of you, please come and talk to me, because I want to make sure, as I talk to the finance chair and we put at least some initial recommendations together, that I have input from everyone on the committee. And so next week, I guess the other thing that we're going to try to squeeze in the next few weeks, we don't have the date set, but we do want to do the LCCMR bill early. That was a commitment made by the entire LCCMR, and so the House has already started moving it, and so that will be something we'll be dealing with the next few weeks. I don't have dates or time set for you, but Mr. Jarofsky's working on scheduling all these things. So that's our plan for the next few weeks. That's it. We're going to end a little bit early, and with that, the meeting's adjourned.